The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. Today we'll be reading a bit from the published magazine as well as the online magazine, and we'll start with an article from Science titled, Could Skin Patches Be the Future of COVID Vaccines? By Emily Mullen. The device might survive longer storage times and pose a better option for people afraid of needles. Around the world, an estimated 49% of individuals have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, but billions more are still waiting for a shot. Just five of Africa's 54 nations are projected to hit the World Health Organization's year-end goal of fully vaccinating at least 40% of their residents, according to an October 28 statement. Shortages of syringes and lack of access to cold storage refrigeration remain major barriers. But researchers are working on new COVID-19 vaccines that could be kept at room temperature and given without a traditional needle and syringe. The latest is described in a study published today in Scientific Advances. A team at the University of Queensland in Australia has developed a skin patch vaccine for COVID-19 that's administered with the click of a small round applicator device to the upper arm. The solid plastic patch is smaller than a fingernail, just 7 by 7 millimeters. On it are 5,000 needle-like projections that enter the skin and deposit the vaccine into the upper dermal layers. Unlike a typical needle, these ones are so tiny that they don't even draw blood or trigger the nerve endings that sense pain. The technology is known as a microneedle patch and is used to deliver insulin, among other drugs. The latest iteration, designed to protect against COVID-19, has only been tested in mice. The scientists made the vaccine by using a nitrogen jet-based drying process to turn a stabilized version of the coronavirus spike protein into powder. They then coated the projections on the patch with the powdered spike protein. In lab tests, they found that the vaccine patch remained stable for up to a month at room temperature and up for a week at 40 degrees Celsius, or around 104 degrees Fahrenheit. In mice, the patch produced higher levels of neutralizing antibodies against SARS-CoV-2 than vaccines delivered by a needle and a syringe. We got fantastic responses, says David Mueller, an author on the paper and a senior research fellow at the University of Queensland. The vaccine patch works by delivering the spike protein to the epidermis. This top layer of skin contains a vast network of specialized immune cells that provide a barrier against bacteria and viruses. These cells act as sentinels for the rest of the body, sending signals to other cells when they encounter an invading pathogen. The skin is a particularly good place to give a vaccine, says Mark Prausnitz, a director of the Center for Drug Design, Development and Delivery at Georgia Tech, who wasn't involved in the study. Our skin is the interface for the body and the outside world, so it's expecting to encounter pathogens now and then, and it understands the need to mount immune responses. Previous studies in animals have shown that skin patch vaccines for other infectious diseases can generate higher levels of antibodies than traditional vaccines that are injected into the muscle. Prausnitz notes that the only infectious disease ever eradicated, smallpox, was done so with a skin vaccine. The smallpox vaccine was administered by puncturing the skin with a two-pronged needle that had been dipped in the vaccine solution. Though the University of Queensland vaccine doesn't use a needle in traditional sense, it does produce a sensation when pressed against the skin. Mueller says the applicator feels like a solid flick against the arm. You remove a foil seal, it goes into your arm, you leave it there for 10 seconds, and then you remove the applicator, he explains. Like with any vaccine, the patch may still leave your arm feeling sore because it delivers an agent that's meant to stimulate an immune response. The patch also produces some redness that usually goes away over the course of a few days. It looks very promising, says Jason McClellan, a structural biologist at the University of Texas at Austin, who helped design the version of the coronavirus spike protein that the Queensland researchers used in their vaccine formulation but wasn't involved in the study. McClellan says a vaccine that doesn't require cold storage would be a boon to less affluent countries, where access to electricity to power refrigeration is spotty or sparse. That's a big advantage over the mRNA COVID-19 vaccines, which require low temperatures, he says. In many parts of the world, having a cold chain is difficult to maintain. Mueller envisions the patch vaccines could eventually be sent through the mail or even delivered by drones to hard-to-reach places without reliable cold storage so that individuals could self-administer them. Other groups are working on shelf-stable vaccine patches that don't require an applicator and would simply stick onto a skin like a Band-Aid, then disappear. These will be virtually painless compared to the University of Queensland's team's solid patch. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University have engineered a fingertip-sized patch that has 400 tiny needles of sugar and protein pieces which dissolve into the skin after delivering the spike protein. In mice, the Pittsburgh team's vaccine produced antibodies at levels thought to be enough to neutralize the coronavirus. Scientists from Stanford and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, meanwhile, are collaborating to make a 3D-printed vaccine skin patch for COVID-19. The small, dissolvable patch elicited an antibody response in mice that was 50 times greater than in vaccine injected under the skin. Skin patches to deliver drugs have been studied for decades. A wide variety of drugs are now available in patch form, including nicotine and contraceptive patches. In recent years, there's been more interest among researchers to develop vaccines delivered this way. Beyond having advantages in resource-poor settings, skin patch vaccines could also help encourage vaccine adoption in other places. Prausnitz thinks more individuals would get the flu vaccine every year if it was less painful and easier to access. There's a real motivation to make it appealing for people to go get it, he says. What if you could pick up your patches at the grocery store on your way home? There's a real motivation to make it appealing for people to go get it, he says. What if you could pick up your patches at the grocery store on your way home and bring them home to your family? For children and adults who wince at the sight of needles, a skin patch could be a less painful and scary option. A study published in May by Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, found that a fear of needles may be a key factor for about 10% of individuals who haven't gotten a COVID-19 vaccine. Skin patch vaccines for flu or COVID-19, for that matter, aren't likely to be widely available for another few years. None of the patch vaccines in development for COVID-19 have been tested in humans yet. The University of Queensland team is aiming to begin an initial clinical trial next year with its partner Vaxis, the Cambridge, Massachusetts-based biotech company that's manufacturing the applicators and patches. Though skin patch vaccines for COVID-19 may still be a few years away, Prausnitz still thinks it's worth investing in them. Many experts predict that the coronavirus will become endemic, and it's possible that booster vaccines will be needed regularly. An easy-to-apply, shelf-stable vaccine option could help ensure that more of the world's population is vaccinated. Another article in the science section on SmithsonianMag.com is Giant Sea Lizards Ruled the Waves While T-Rex Roamed on Land, by Riley Black. A new fossil discovery shows marine reptiles called mosasaurs lived up until the asteroid impact that killed non-avian dinosaurs. There hardly were a more fearsome family of seagoing carnivores than the mosasaurs. From the time the first of these marine lizards slipped into the oceans about 98 million years ago, mosasaurs diversified into a widespread array of aquatic ambush predators that fed on everything from dinosaurs washed out to sea to other mosasaurs. And while it was once thought that those reptiles started to disappear from Earth's oceans millions of years before a catastrophic asteroid strike closed the Cretaceous period, a fossil find in North Dakota is helping to rewrite the history of these voracious lizards. The Hell Creek Formation of the western United States is most famous for fossils of Tyrannosaurus, Triceratops, Pachycephalosaurus, and other dinosaurs that roamed the forests and swamps of the region 66 million years ago. But parts of the Hell Creek Formation also preserve pools of what was once ocean, the remainders of a vast western interior seaway that split North America in two. In one of these pockets of marine strata, a private landowner found a curious fossil, an isolated piece of a creature's backbone, and took it to the North Dakota Geological Survey for identification. The bone had come from a large mosasaur, and further examination of the site turned up part of a mosasaur's jaw. The giant lizards hadn't vanished long before the impact. The bones added to an emerging picture that the ocean's apex predators were still prowling the Cretaceous seas until the day the asteroid struck, the conclusion of a paper published in August in the journal Paleobios. Up until now, note study author and WVU Potomac State College paleontologist Nathan Van Vranken, most mosasaur finds from North America had come from sites along the ancient Atlantic coast and Gulf of Mexico. As sea levels fell and the western interior seaway drained off the continent, it seemed that mosasaurs that once dominated those waters disappeared as the once thriving ecosystems turned into a strange love ocean, where the water became more acidic and plankton died off en masse. Such a harsh environment was thought to lack enough prey for mosasaurs and other large predators to survive. But the new find from North Dakota indicates that large mosasaurs were still present in the last remaining parts of the ancient seaway in the middle of the continent. They still persisted until the end, Van Vranken says. Part of the difficulty in investigating the history of mosasaurs is not all of these animals lived in places that readily became preserved. The catch was trying to understand extinct animal diversity, as they were at the mercy of the fossil record, which is far from perfect, says Richard Gilder, graduate school paleontologist Amelia Zetlow, who was not involved in the new study. Some mosasaur species had adaptations for cruising deep open waters far from coast, she notes, and these species are much harder to find than those that live near coastlines where sediment could rapidly bury a mosasaur's body. Still, multiple finds in recent years have indicated that mosasaurs were going strong right up until the moment the Cretaceous closed. The new study adds to the picture by indicating mosasaurs were still present in the last remnants of the western interior seaway. The mosasaur uncovered in North Dakota was a large one, identified as either Prognathodon or Mosasaurus in the new paper. Either way, this was a big animal and an apex predator in its habitat. Prognathodon has been estimated to reach lengths in excess of 33 feet, and the biggest Mosasaurus species got to be even larger, around 59 feet, or nearly 20 feet longer than the biggest T. rex. While smaller mosasaurs likely fed on fish and invertebrates, Van Vranken says, the large ones nabbed larger prey such as sharks and other marine reptiles. They were totally, absolutely, unquestionably apex marine predators, and the only thing a full-grown mosasaur needed to fear was other larger mosasaurs, Zetlow says. The particular animal uncovered in North Dakota, Van Vranken notes, probably caught whatever it could as the last remaining pool of ocean was disappearing. Then mosasaurs became extinct worldwide when the ecological shocks of a massive asteroid's impact quickly and dramatically shook up Earth's environments. The fate of the last mosasaurs was a cap on more than 30 million years of evolutionary history. Early mosasaurs were descended from a monitor-like lizard ancestor that adapted to a marine lifestyle, Van Vranken says, possibly during a time when sea levels were rising worldwide and new food sources were available for reptiles that didn't mind getting their feet wet. Fossils such as the Dallosaurus and the Russellosaurus, both found in the Cretaceous rocks of Texas, offer hints that these first mosasaurs looked like creatures caught in between a Komodo dragon and a Mosasaurus. Throughout the millions of years of Cretaceous history that followed, the feet of mosasaurs became adapted into paddles. Their scales became keeled and streamlined, and some species evolved downward kinked tails that supported a shark-like tail fin. And while a few mosasaurs evolved bulbous, rounded teeth for crushing shells, such as the aptly named globitons, most were sharp-toothed predators that fed on just about anything they could nab. And one of the most distinctive features of mosasaurs was a second row of pointed teeth on their palate, an extra spiky trap that helped prevent struggling prey from escaping. Paleontologists have found indentations of the reptile's impressive teeth on the shells of squid relatives called ammonites, pardon me, demonstrating how the lizards grabbed and crushed their shelly meals. Just with dinosaurs, the image of mosasaurs paleontologists are putting together differs from the Hollywood version that quickly gained stardom in Jurassic World. The kaiju-sized Hollywood version has munched sharks, pterosaurs, dinosaurs, and humans during its on-screen rampages, perhaps staying true to the voracious mosasaur reputation. But aside from being quite a bit smaller, Zetlau says, large mosasaurs like Mosasaurus and Tylosaurus had snake-like scales and would have had lips covering their teeth instead of a maw of snaggle-toothed chompers. Nevertheless, the living animals must have been just as impressive as their box office counterparts. Mosasaurs are literally real-life sea monsters, Zetlau says. They have a double row of teeth, whale-like flippers, a shark tail, beautiful streamlined skulls, and are the biggest lizards to ever live. What's not to love? Next, we'll move on to a more timely article, Five Important Questions About COP26 Answered. Representatives from nearly 200 nations are expected to meet and report on climate change promises made in the Paris Agreement by Corin Wetzel. This is from October 29, 2021. This Sunday, more than 20,000 political leaders, organizations, and activists will gather in the world's largest climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, with one shared goal: to address the growing threat of climate change. The annual meeting, COP26, falls in a narrow window of opportunity when nations need to collectively ratchet up targets to avoid severe climate catastrophe in the not-distant future. At this year's meeting, nearly 200 nations will report on how they are or aren't fulfilling promises made at the 2015 Climate Summit in Paris, which aimed to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, by the end of the century. Even if countries stick to goals set in the Paris Agreement, scientists say current policies aren't enough to spare vulnerable nations from the impacts of the changing climate. Here's what you need to know as politicians prepare to report on their progress and set new goals. What is COP26? The Conference of the Parties, or COP, is the main decision-making body of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, an agreement originally made by 197 countries to slow the pace of climate change. Since the first summit in Berlin in 1995, delegates have met for 2 weeks each November, with the exception of last year's postponement due to the COVID-19 pandemic, to hash out specific climate pledges. This year's summit is the 26th, hence the name COP26. At previous meetings, government leaders have put forth agreements and pledges that have been met with varied success. The 2015 agreement made in Paris called on all parties in the conference to reduce greenhouse gas production and increase renewable types of energy like wind, solar, and wave power. Rather than a single rule being imposed on all parties, individual countries pledge and work to meet their own goals, many of which are shared by other nations. At previous meetings, government leaders have put forth agreements and pledges that have been met with varied success. The 2015 agreement made in Paris called on all parties in the conference to reduce greenhouse gas production and increase. Yeah. Every country is called upon to make a contribution, says John Furlow, director of the International Research Institute for Climate and Society at Columbia University's Climate School. It's a voluntary contribution. There's meant to be a system of transparency. The idea being that if we can see what China and Germany and Japan are doing, the United States will want to do that as well as they are, and vice versa. Who will be there? The conference will bring together some of the most powerful political leaders in the world, including United States President Joe Biden, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Pope Francis, and more than 100 other heads of state. COP26 also has a public-facing side of the event, including exhibitions and events showcasing climate solutions and emerging technologies. Academics, indigenous leaders, and climate activists like Greta Thunberg of Sweden and Sir David Attenborough of England will also be in attendance. The event, which is held at Glasgow's Scottish Event Campus, anticipates thousands of protesters. Some delegates haven't committed to attending COP26 yet, most notably President Xi Jinping of China, a nation that is currently world's top greenhouse gas emitter. Leaders from lower-income and small island nations feeling the brunt of climate change may be missing from conversations, too, says Harriet Bulkley, a geographer at Durham University. We know that a lot of people won't be able to attend who should be there, she says. It's often going to be some of the most marginalized voices for whom this kind of journey in these current conditions is just unfeasible, either logistically, politically, or financially. Why is this summit so important? It's been 5 years since countries made pledges in Paris, and they're expected to report and declare even more ambitious goals at this year's meeting. The latest report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released in August, warns that human activities have unequivocally heated the planet and that climate change is fueling extreme weather events, flooding, and the rapid loss of species. New commitments made at COP26 can include adding more electric cars on the road, curtailing deforestation, and moving away from fossil fuel-based heating. One initiative being launched at COP26 is the Global Methane Pledge, which aims to curb the emissions of the potent greenhouse gas by at least 30% from 2020 levels by 2030. So far, a total of 24 countries, including the U.S., are on board. Another pledge from countries like the U.S. and Australia aims to bring global energy-related carbon dioxide emissions to net zero by 2050, a stringent goal some say is needed to slow the rapid pace of warming. Ultimately, that means phasing out things like coal and gas and switching to renewable sources like wind and solar. Any emissions from gas-powered cars, for example, would have to be offset by pulling carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Despite the roughly three-month span in which the United States wasn't a member of the Paris Agreement, President Biden says the country is still on track to meet goals set in 2015. Major emitters like China, Saudi Arabia, and Russia have yet to put forth pledges, and whether they'll do so before the summit begins at the end of the week is not clear. How are top-emitting countries stepping up? At the 2009 conference in Copenhagen, delegates set a goal of providing $100 billion each year to support lower-income nations transition away from fossil fuels starting this year. But funding appears to have fallen short, and some experts are skeptical that $100 billion is enough to finance the transition. Added pressure is being put on the world's top greenhouse gas emitters to make the most ambitious promises. The G20, an intergovernmental group of the world's biggest economies, collectively accounts for around 75% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Lower-income countries tend to have economies built around climate-sensitive goods, like agriculture and other natural resources, and are often hit worse by climate disasters. I can imagine there's a real sense of helplessness in a small country or low-emissions country that is feeling the impacts of this change that are happening, says Furlow. It has to depend on others to reduce emissions to solve the problem. At the COP21 summit, nations agreed to collectively commit to limit global temperature rise by the end of the 21st century to 2 degrees Celsius and pursue efforts to keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, the threshold scientists say is necessary for avoiding the worst impacts of climate change. The planet is already more than 1 degree Celsius warmer than before the Industrial Age, and a jump from 1.5 to 2 degrees could lead to 2 extra inches of sea level rise, putting around 10 million people at risk of coastal flooding. Even something that is as seemingly small as half a degree really does matter, says Brendan Guy, climate strategist at the Natural Resources Defense Council. In September of this year, a report from the United Nations warned the country's Paris targets were too weak, leaving the planet on pace to warm by almost 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. If all COP member states can cut global emissions to net zero by 2050, that could keep warming under 1.5 degrees Celsius. We have made progress over the last dozen years or so, but it's clearly not enough, says Guy. The mounting impacts of climate change have shown us that we don't have time to be tepid or for any half measures. Now is the time to really be bold. We'll finish today's episode with a couple smart news pieces. We'll start with one, California Condor Surprise Scientists with Two Virgin Births, by Rashi Aridi. Genetic data revealed that two females laid fatherless eggs. Parthenogenesis, also known as virgin birth, is a type of asexual reproduction in which a female's egg can develop into an embryo without sperm. Lizards do it, swell sharks do it, even water dragons do it. In a surprising twist, scientists found that California condors are also able to reproduce this way, reports Sarah Harrison for Wired. The California condor's population stooped dangerously low to 22 individuals in the 1980s. In a race to save the critically endangered species, scientists captured the remaining condors and began a captive breeding program that is still running. With such a small genetic pool and a fragile population, the breeding has to be meticulously planned and documented, reports Sarah Zhang for The Atlantic. When scientists at the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance were reviewing the bird's genetic data, they found something puzzling. Two male chicks known as SB260 and SB517 didn't have genetic contribution from any males in the program, reports Jason Biddle for the National Geographic. They published their findings this week in the Journal of Heredity. This is truly an amazing discovery. We were not exactly looking for evidence of parthenogenesis. It just hit us in the face. Co-author Oliver Ryder, a geneticist at the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance, says in a press release, "We only confirmed it because of the normal genetic studies we do to prove parentage. Both condor chicks died before reaching sexual maturity, but other parthenotes, like domesticated turkeys, pigeons, and chickens, usually die before hatching. SB260 only lived for 2 years before dying in 2003 in the wild, likely from malnourishment. SB517 was unusually small and remained in captivity until he died of a foot infection at nearly 8 years old in 2017, reports Wired. They certainly weren't, shall we say, shining specimens of the condor. Damian Chapman, a biologist at the Mote Marine Laboratory and Aquarium, tells The Atlantic. California condors can live to about 60 years, and Ryder says parthenogenesis itself could have led to the parthenote's early demise. The young birds may have developed genetic mutations that caused underlying problems since they didn't have the genetic diversity that is added from the DNA of another parent, reports National Geographic. Parthenogenesis is a rare occurrence, but some evidence suggests that females capable of parthenogenesis will reproduce this way when there aren't any mates around, which could happen with an imperiled population. Scientists suspect that's pushed the critically endangered small-toothed sawfish to parthenogenesis in the wild. For that reason, it's more common for females in captivity to reproduce asexually if they don't have mates in their enclosure. But in a puzzling twist to this theory, the female California condors who laid these eggs were living with males, reports National Geographic. They made it with their partners before and after the parthenotes were born, leaving the team to wonder, why would these birds reproduce asexually? The researchers don't have an answer yet, but they're working on it. The team caught these two parthenotes while reviewing the genetic data, but there could be more, because their births happened twice at separate times and with different females, so it could be a recurring oddity, Ryder tells Wild. In their lifetimes, they weren't even recognized to be parthenotes. We definitely keep our eyes out anytime we catch a blood sample for testing, Ryder tells Gizmodo. Ryder hopes that some parthenotes born in the past slipped past the team and grew to be healthy adults, which could benefit the species in the future, he tells Wild. Because the species is so imperiled, now with the population at about 500 individuals, every new egg counts. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.